She had never been to this town, but from paintings and engraved maps she had seen, in so much better and happier times, she had an idea of its layout, and that gave her an idea of where to look. The town was built around a steep hill, a rock about 300 feet high that some geological quirk had deposited here. At the top of the hill stood the castle, now in ruins. A paved street curved up from the town's main square. After a few hundred feet, the houses on both sides ended, and the street, getting steeper, became a path. On the left side, if you walked up, carved into the mountain, was a row of caves, one next to the other. Underground stalls that had been shops where on sunny days a steady stream of cheerfully jostling, laughing, shouting visitors, but also more quiet townspeople on a stroll up to the castle gardens, had bought refreshments, candies, shawls, hats, bags, local artwork, antiques and cheap jewelry, fake and real, and, generally speaking, useful or useless trinkets of all kinds. Now only a few of those stalls were open. The rest either had their heavy iron-studded doors firmly locked and shut, or had been deprived of their doors, leaving bare gaping holes in the rock, most of them with their walls black from fires that had consumed the shelves, the merchandise, and, it was to be feared, also the merchants. Holes that showed the dimensions of those stalls, about 6 feet wide, maybe 8 feet high, and hardly more than 20 feet deep. She paid no attention to the closed doors, but glanced into the open stalls, the empty ones, and the few that were occupied, their owners, whether male or female, hardly bothering to look back at her, their faces empty, knowing that in trying to sell their worthless goods to non-existent buyers, they were just going through the motions, passing the time here to avoid having to pass it somewhere else. The wind blew a drizzling rain into her face now. Ahead of her, the path led to a wall that had surrounded the castle gardens. The trellised gate in it, through which visitors had streamed to enjoy the greenery, the clean air, and the view over the city, now barred with heavy chains and solid rusty locks. To her right, the ground sloped down towards the town below it, but trees blocked the view. To her left, the door of the last of the stalls, of the caves in the rock, stood ajar. She entered, closing it behind her. She was alone. The room, with its rough walls hewn out of the rock, was almost empty, except for crudely made shelves left and right, displaying rather artless pottery and some pictures, watercolours and charcoal drawings, a few of them crudely framed and standing, others lying in a few thin stacks, the top ones having gathered dust. On the top shelf stood a dozen burning candles, an astonishing luxury, given how scarce and expensive candles had become. At the back of the cave, several coats, worn and tattered, were hanging from a row of iron cloak hooks. Someone must have had quite a heavy hammer to drive them into the rock. The pottery seemed of little interest, but I took a closer look at the pictures.
Wait, I? Who is I?
I shrugged.
She? Her? Me? I?
You know this is my story. I'm telling it. So do you want me to continue or not? Of course they did. The pictures were of a fairly good quality, of a talented amateur kind. Vistas of the town, landscapes, the stuff that was, or had been, sold to tourists. Something seemed right. Something seemed wrong.
Come in, a female voice said. Here is another room where you can see more of my stuff.
The voice had come from behind the coats. There was a narrow passage, its walls as roughly hewn as those of the cave, bent so that what lay behind it wasn't visible from where it opened.
I walked through. It opened into a vast underground chamber with stonework walls, arches, and vaulted roofs. Candles were burning on huge iron candlesticks and on ledges protruding from the walls. Oil lamps were burning on tables, which, apart from a few pillows on the uneven stone floor, were the only furniture. The woman standing next to one of those tables was older than I was, simply dressed, not looking much different from those in the other open stalls that I had seen. Only her eyes were more alert, and she seemed more eager to strike up a conversation.
"You wonder at the candles," she said. "We are in the cellars of the castle here. It's a huge system of underground caverns, connected by tunnels and stairs, a labyrinth in which you can get lost and perish if you don't first fall victim to one of the numerous deadly traps. Much of it is empty, some of it is crumbling. But if you know where to look, there are things to be found. A huge stockpile of candles, for instance." Why did she tell me all this? Again, something seemed right, something seemed wrong. But increasingly, I got the exciting feeling that there was something.
"Others do not fight you for those hidden treasures?" I asked.
"The castle is haunted," she said. "They tend to keep away. It's for their own good." There was an undertone of menace in her voice now.
"It's you who haunts the castle," I said.
"Of course," she replied. "But haven't you come to look at the pictures? See if you want to buy one?"
I took up a batch from one of the tables and leafed through them, when, suddenly, my eyes fell on one that stood on the floor, leaning against a wall, half hidden in one of the many recesses, but still visible enough to anyone who entered this hall. A charcoal drawing, larger than most of the others, a landscape. The reedy shore of a lake, in the morning mist. A heron, rising from a shallow piece of open water. Above it, as in the direction of the path of its flight, gleaming through the mist and a patchy cover of thin clouds, a crescent moon, and the morning star. There was no mistaking it. I yelled as I grabbed a burning oil lamp and threw it, as it shattered on the floor and the oil spilled out and the flames leaped up and consumed the paper, lake, heron, moon, and star.
"You irresponsible, reckless, stupid fool!" I screamed, overwhelmed, hardly noticing how irresponsible it was of me to scream, not knowing with certainty that no one else but this stupid woman was able to hear me. I tried to get my emotions under control. What the picture said must be wrong. The queen couldn't be alive, could she? But if she was, this was not something to be shouted about, for anyone, friend or foe, so plain to see. In either case, displaying something like this was indefensible.
"How could you dare to draw this?" I asked. "You're not a messenger." This was not a question. I had seen enough to know she wasn't.
"I had been so lonely," she replied. "Forgive me." "No, I'm not. But I have been with one. We had been close. And then she died for me."
"She died for you? You should have died for her." If anything, I was angrier now at her than before.
"Maybe," she said. "I was wounded. Alone, all I could do was wait. I have waited a long time for you, my sister."
"Don't you dare to call me sister," I said. "You are not one of us." In her eyes, I could see that she understood even before I did. Not one of us. To someone who wasn't, whoever she was, under no circumstances would I have been allowed to say this. I didn't like it at all. From what I had seen of her, I didn't really think she deserved it, but I had no choice. I drew my knife, the shiny steel knife with the pointed tip. "You understand what I have to do," I said. She knew, and she knew the rules, and she showed that she accepted by taking off her clothes. She stood before me naked, a bit heavier than me, larger breasts, older, but in good shape, except that, like me, she had deep scars. She looked at me as I stepped up to her, and she did not flinch as the knife broke her skin. It was done quickly, with little blood, a tiny trickle down one of her thighs. It had not yet reached her knee before I had stepped back. "As long as the scars are visible, for about a year, they will show to anyone of the sisterhood that I have authorized your protection. See to it that in this time you make contact with someone who can do more for you. And now tell me what you know about the Queen." I must have blinked because I only sensed rather than saw a sudden blurred movement, felt before I could move, a touch, an impact that I could not locate. And then she was standing 12 feet away from me, and I saw my knife in her hand. It did not point at me. It was not a weapon for her. It was a mirror. She held it between her thighs, so that in its shiny surface she could see the cuts I had made. "Well done, messenger," she said. She took another look. Trained by himself, quite a distinction. But for a queen's messenger, you are slow to comprehend. It hit me with her first words. The rest I was hardly able to hear. A huge wave of shame washed over me, drowned me, took my breath away. Another unforgivable failure added to my other ones. Slow, so slow had been my thoughts. Yes, of course. I saw it now. She had always spoken the truth, spoken the plain truth when she had admitted that she was not one of the Queen's messengers, when she said that she had only been with one, that they had been lovers, that her lover had died for her. "I resign," I said, my breath just sufficing for those two short words. There were no other words for me to say, now or ever. For a messenger, there was only one way to resign. Only one person to resign to. Only one way the resignment could be received. I looked at the knife that she still held in her hand. I looked at her face as she threw it, and marveled that this was all the emotion she showed when she took a life, a hint of amusement. But it was her face, the Queen's face. So it was well. The knife was a flashing blur at the periphery of my vision. I felt the impact under my left breast where the heart is. I felt the impact. I felt death. It hurt, but only mildly. I looked down at death just in time to catch the knife as it fell, the end of its hilt having bounced off my chest. "Don't be ridiculous," she said. "I've said well done. And besides, what do you think I've spent all that time waiting for? I need you." My audience of two applauded. Alma Guest and his sister, my lover, the Queen. Only about a month ago we had met, on the day that our fathers had died from each other's hands. "A nice story, but did you really have to kill me for it?" she said.
"For that somewhat overdramatic finale, I think it was necessary," Alma Guest came to my defense. "And what better thing to give your life for but art?"
"As long as it happens within the art," I said.
but you didn't die, neither of you. You were both badly wounded, and you thought it better to pass on the burden of queenship to someone else, at least for a while. But I've left this out. I wanted to stay with making my point.
And you've made it, Almagest said.
So, his sister said, you suggest that we build a corps of loyal, well-trained fighters, the Sisterhood of the Messengers.
More than well-trained and loyal, unmatched in both, I interrupted. 60, I think, would be a good number. I want to be one of them. I needed a task. I could not spend my time here in friendship and love without something to do.
As a reserve to fall back on, after a devastating breakdown of order and peace.
No, no, I said. To prevent it. Something like what I've described must never happen. We must keep it from happening.
And so far, the 60 of us and Almagest and my lover, the Queen, we have.